ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Russian President Vladimir Putin promised retribution for Friday's attack on a concert hall in Moscow. Authorities now say over 130 people were killed. ISIS claimed responsibility, but ABC's Patrick Riebel says Russian authorities are pointing at Ukraine.
The FSB now claims that the attackers had contacts in Ukraine. Ukrainian officials have vehemently denied any involvement. They accuse Russia of trying to exploit this attack to further mobilize Russians for the war against Ukraine.
The Senate passed a $1.2 trillion spending bill, which funds the government for the rest of the fiscal year. President Biden's expected to sign it today. The president and first lady sent messages of support to Kate, the Princess of Wales, after she announced she is being treated for cancer. And the FBI sent a letter to passengers on the Alaska Airlines flight that saw a door plug blow off in midair in January that they might be the victims of a crime. This is ABC News. Federal Trade Commission study examined how grocery stores fared during the pandemic, and the answer is pretty well, according to ABC's Sherry Preston.
A new FTC report called Feeding America in a Time of Crisis looks at the supply chain problems that hobbled grocery stores amid the COVID outbreak. One of the things they found out was that annual profits for food and beverage retailers rose substantially during the pandemic and are still elevated. The paper says more study is needed, but it does cast some doubt on grocery store chains' claims that the reason for passing higher prices onto consumers was that they were countering their own rising costs. Sherry Preston, ABC News.
West Virginia Governor Jim Justice signed a law allowing public school teachers to answer student questions about scientific theories of how the universe or life came to exist. Supporters say it promotes the free exchange of ideas in the classroom. Opponents say it's so vague it could allow religion to enter public schools. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
This message is for Shauna, my mom, who just finished her high school diploma. I wanted to say I'm so proud of you for finishing school. You taught me it's never too late to achieve your dreams. I hope to make you as proud as you have made me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
The John and Gordy Show.
By the way, yes. This Wednesday we'll be at the Short Stack Eatery, 301 West Johnson Street, with a live broadcast. 301 West Johnson.
Your voices, your voices are so smooth sounding now.
Pancakes.
Relaxing.
Oh, I just love those pancakes, don't you?
Yes. Why don't you join us at Short Stack Eatery this coming Wednesday?
I love their sweaty stack.
Weekday mornings 6 until 8 on Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX and on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Wisconsin is getting some help from Washington to connect rural communities to high-speed internet. Mike Mohn has more.
Governor Tony Evers and the Public Service Commission say Wisconsin's blueprint for digital equity has been accepted by the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. That means the state is eligible for up to $30 million to implement its approach over the next 5 years. Martha Cranley, State Director for AARP Wisconsin, calls it a robust plan, noting that older populations continue to face challenges in being connected to the digital world.
We know that at least 15% of people 50 plus in Wisconsin are not connected, either because the wires simply don't come to their house, or they don't have a device, or they don't know how to use it.
Cranley says the lack of connection is especially concerning in rural areas across northern Wisconsin, where aging communities have limited resources. Stakeholders also note an infusion of new aid is helpful with the federal government's Affordable Connectivity Program, which provides discounts on monthly internet bills for eligible households in danger of running out of money. Cranley says the state's plan came together following extensive public outreach, in which her organization helped convey the need for improved internet access for those 50 and older.
They certainly heard from older people about how important this is to connect to their doctor and to connect to government services and, frankly, find employment.
Overall, Governor Evers says the plan's federal approval means more than 410,000 homes and businesses will be better positioned to be connected to new or improved high-speed internet service. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
With weather, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly cloudy and highs in the low 40s. Snow likely tonight, lows around 25. Some snow on Sunday with a high near 40 degrees. Southeast winds up to 25 miles per hour. Rain and snow Sunday night, a low near 35. And rain for Monday, maybe even a rumble of thunder.
Right now, it's 22.
Broadcasting from Civic Media Global Headquarters on State Street, this is Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, March 23rd, 2024. My name is Jim Santel. I'm with you this hour. Also the next hour on our newly restyled, our reimagined program, Saturday morning, talking with you from the studios of WAUK in downtown Waukesha, but reaching out to broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout the Wisconsin area and beyond. I am here in the studio with my extraordinary producer, Anya, and together this morning, we're presenting to you the first in hopefully a long series of newly styled programs. A lot of the content, a lot of the substance, much the same as it has been before, but some new styling, some new packaging, some new ways of thinking about what we do here every Saturday morning. This is our 90th broadcast on the networks of Civic Media since our start way back in June of 2022. Today, we're building on those foundations, both stylistic and content related, of our Saturday morning broadcasts, formerly known as Morning Cannolis. And today, this modestly restyled information and civics-centric program, continuing to focus on those core goals and aspirations that have been a part of our broadcast since we went on the air in June of 2022. What are those? We're going to continue to focus on the identification and hopefully clear exposition of some of those most important news stories, so those events in our lives in the areas of law and government and courts, and yes, the delivery of justice as well. In addition to that, explanations, descriptions of the reasons why all of these local, national, and yes, worldwide events are relevant, why they're meaningful, why they're significant and important to our lives. Third, an examination, an explanation, if you will, of the practical trappings and specific aspects of the legal, the governmental, and rule of law issues in these news items. We're going to be spending some time today talking inside one of those cases about specifically those kinds of trappings. And finally, hopefully, some instructions, some perspectives on the intersection of the law, both procedural and substantive, with what? With civic responsibility. That's why you've come here in the morning in the engagement with our community. Now, our new name for our Saturday morning broadcast, Amicus, a law review with me, Jim Santel. Thrilled to have you with me this morning, hopefully for both hours. Let's talk about where that name comes from initially. Let's talk about why we've decided to rename our show just this. Amicus Curiae is an individual and organization that is not a party to a legal case, but is permitted to assist a court by offering some relevant information, some expertise, or some insight that might have some bearing on the issues in the particular case. That's how it's often described inside legal circles. The phrase amicus is legal Latin. And the origin of the term, believe it or not, has been traced way back to 1605, maybe as late as 1615. The scope of an amicus situation, generally found in those cases where there's some broad public interest and the concerns might involve things like civil rights, human rights, those kinds of things we've seen a lot in courts in America in contemporary times. In American law, amicus curiae typically refers to what in some jurisdictions is known as an intervener, somebody who's coming into the case for the first time. That is a person or an organization who requests from the court, you have to get leave of court, to provide some legal submission, some writing, some document, so as to offer a relevant alternative or some additional perspective regarding the matters in dispute. In some other jurisdictions like Canada, amicus curiae is a lawyer who is asked by the court to provide some legal submissions, something about the case before it that would not otherwise be argued by the attorneys, by the counsel, by the parties who have legitimate but relatively narrow interests in succeeding on the merits of their cases. Because one or both of the parties is not represented by counsel. That could also be the case where the court also wants to have some input from some outside source. One of my favorite quotes about what amicus is all about comes, believe it or not, from Great Britain, the Queen's Bench there. Lord Justice of Appeal Cyril Salmon said in Allen versus Sir Alfred McAlpine versus Sons Limited, a case in 1968, he said, "I always understand that the role of an amicus was to help the court by expounding the law impartially, without partisan view, or if one of the parties was unrepresented, by advancing the legal arguments on his behalf, once again providing this assistance, this help, this informative direction for the court that might not otherwise come from the pure representations made by the lawyers in the case. Sometimes it does, but not always." The situation of having an amicus curiae, often noted in the press, is when an adversary or advocacy group of some kind files a brief in a case before an appellate court, typically, in which it is not a litigant. Appellate cases, of course, normally limited to the factual record that comes up from the trial court, the district court below. And attorneys, of course, as I already indicated, focus on the facts and the arguments that are most favorable to their clients. And that's legitimate. That's how our system works. That's what we embrace in our system of justice here in the United States and in many other nations throughout the world. But when a case has some broader implications, amicus curiae briefs are a way to articulate those concerns, to get those issues, those perspectives to the court so that these possibly broad legal or public policy issues, the implications of what the court might do, the anticipated decisions, are informed by that additional information that comes from this additional source, this amicus, not dependent solely on the positions and the arguments that are advanced by the parties involved in the case. In the United States Supreme Court, which we're going to be spending a lot of time today talking about, the United States Supreme Court also has special rules for amicus petitions. Amicus curiae briefs sought to be filed in cases pending before it happens all the time. Supreme Court Rule 37, there it is. Here's your first piece of Supreme Court practice for you this morning under the rubric of our newly styled show. Supreme Court Rule 37 states in part that an amicus brief should cover, quote, relevant matters not dealt with by the parties, which may be of considerable help. In fact, the cover of an amicus brief has to identify which party the brief is supporting, or if the brief supports only some affirmance or reversal, got to tell the court what it is your ultimate position is, even as you're providing this assistance, this direction from this additional source. The court also requires that all non-governmental amicus briefs identify those providing any monetary contribution to the preparation or submission of the brief. Why? We've talked a lot about this on this broadcast. You want to know if indeed the particular group that's filing an amicus brief that is represented by an amicus in the case has some financial interest in that. That's important. That's relevant to know for the court to understand when it takes a look at the positions being presented in the particular brief.
Briefs have to be prepared in a booklet format, and 40 copies must be served upon the court. All of that for all of your assistance, so that when each one of you seeks permission from the Supreme Court under Rule 37 to file an amicus brief, an amicus brief in front of the Supreme Court, you know how the process goes. In the United States Supreme Court, unless the amicus brief is being filed by the federal government, and again, the federal government, the Solicitor General of the United States of America, has special dispensation not to get permission. In all other cases, permission of the court by means of a motion to leave. You have to file a specific petition with the Supreme Court, asking the members of the Supreme Court, can we please file an amicus brief with you? Or there has to be some mutual consent of the parties. Some of that is generally required before you can simply file a brief. So even though I'm encouraging you to do that in these important cases coming up, you have to get permission from the court to submit that brief before the clerk of court will place it on the docket. Allowing an amicus curiae brief to present oral argument is fairly extraordinary. The amicus who writes the brief, highly unusual for that person, that entity, that legal entity to appear for oral argument. We're going to talk a lot about oral arguments today as well. And the court, believe it or not, can appoint its own amicus. If neither party supports the decision of the lower court, in other words, there's nobody advocating for what happened below the decision by the lower court, the court can also appoint an amicus, and that person can write an amicus brief. That has been done at least 44 times in the history of our Supreme Court. Often happens that these kinds of amicus briefs are filed routinely. We have seen that a lot in the civil rights cases, the human rights cases, including those cases presented to the Supreme Court and other courts as well in our recent contemporary history. That is your briefing this morning on the word amicus and amicus curiae, which, again, this notion of providing assistance, support, some counsel, if you will, some direction on what these things mean, some perspective that may not otherwise be provided. And yes, indeed, that's the reason why we here at Civic Media have decided to embrace that as the word, as our new moniker, our new name for our Saturday morning broadcast that explains what we hope to do as a part of our presentation of the facts of cases, our identification of why those facts are important, our description of those legal trappings, and then the perspectives on engagement in the community, all of that by virtue of our newly adopted amicus approach to provide you, friend of the court, friend of this station, but friend of the community, most importantly, with information that's helpful and insightful for understanding the larger issues. That has always been our commission for the previous 89 broadcasts, and it is our commission again on this, our 90th broadcast, as we go forward under our new name, Amicus, a Law Review. More about that in the future as we talk further about what we're going to be doing here. Now, along the way, as I indicated, the fundamental content, the substance of our broadcast is going to remain substantively much the same as it has been before, reviewing those fundamental issues again in the area of law and government, courts, and the delivery of justice, the aspiration for justice, as we have often called it on this particular show. In addition to that, of course, in normal presentations, normal programs, we're also going to be soliciting your calls. We're not going to be doing that this morning because we got so much material to address, and Anya and I are going to get to that right after this coming break. We're going to talk more about our newly styled program and get into the content of Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Mad Radio WMDX, Madison's home for the Todd Lovell Show.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh. Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. brought to you by the Ad Council and its pre-diabetes awareness partners.
The Todd Alba Show.
Our ride into spring continues. We have some great prizes to give away. A weekend getaway at Chula Vista Resort, a bike, and a three-way blender.
A three-in-one blender.
Oh, three-in-one. Sorry, I misread that. We're having our own political threesome
Todd
here.
Todd Alba going with the After Dark Show all of a sudden.
It's always a pleasure.
This is Civic Media, not Cinemax, Todd.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Mad Radio 92.7 FM, home of the John and Gordy Show.
The radio station and on the app.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home. Welcome back to this, our newly styled, our newly reimagined Saturday morning broadcast. Lots of the same content, lots of the same focus. And as we go forward, we're going to still be including in our broadcasts on a regular basis, including somewhat this morning, some special segments that will occasionally populate our broadcast. Those include things like Undiscovered Justice. We've done this a lot, reviewing and considering those relevant, significant law-related developments that have not been extensively covered in the mainstream media, but that nonetheless warrant our public understanding and our appreciation. We'll be doing some rule of law snapshots as well, some brief sort of headline type mentions of non-major events that nonetheless illustrate some significant issues in the areas of civics and justice related points. We're also going to be talking about microscopic justice. We're going to be delving into deep inside expositions and explanations of some major news stories, often including some recitations of key quotations, some language, again, to establish a more focused civics education as a part of our role as amicus in behalf of our community. And finally, we're going to be introducing down the road a new segment called Law Review Case Notes, invoking some components of academic law journals, kind of an expression of mine, some opinions of mine, perspectives of mine, some of which I have provided before, but a more organized way of doing that, some rational, hopefully balanced views on the significant rule of law events that we discuss every single week here on our Saturday morning broadcast. Now, in addition to those continuing aspects of our Saturday morning broadcast, of course, you're noticing some new music. Anya and my other wonderful producers putting that together for us every single Saturday morning. We're hearing at the start of our program a solo from Michael Gundlach, G-U-N-D-L-A-C-H. It's called Crazy Blues Jazz Piano Solo. That's the underlying music for our entry music and our entry into our broadcast every Saturday morning. A special treat today, just because it is our inaugural program under the Amicus moniker. A special treat is at the end of our second hour, at the end of this 10 o'clock hour, and our final segment before a couple of programming notes for the future. We're going to play, Anya and I, we're going to play the entire piece presented by Michael Gundlach, Crazy Blues Jazz Piano Solo, to bring out our stories of the day, to lead us out into the rest of the day at the conclusion of our two-hour program this morning. As always, we are reaching out to stations throughout Wisconsin and beyond. I want to make a special note of those stations and listeners throughout the state of Wisconsin, now a part of our Amicus family this morning through the Civic Media broadcast opportunities. Those include, of course, right here in Waukesha, the Shaw 101 FM, 540 AM. In Madison, our friends in Madison at Mad Radio WMDX, that's 92.7 FM, 1580 AM. In Wausau, Bull Falls Radio, WXCO, that's 98.9 FM, 1230 AM.
Wausau.
In Wausau, yes, go Wausau, right, Anya?
Yes, sir.
There you go. In Wisconsin Rapids, we've got locally grown radio. That's WFHR. That's 97.5 FM. That's 1320 AM. Richland Center. Richland Center News from the Center. WRCE. That's 107.7 FM. 1450 AM. In Amory, 107.5 FM. 1260 AM. That's Lake Air. WLAK. In the great place, great city of Oshkosh, we've got the Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, that's 98.3 FM, 1100 AM. In Green Bay, the talk of Green Bay at WGBW, that's 97.9 FM, 1590 AM. In Hayward, we broadcast a bit from Hayward not too long ago.
That's Buzz of the North, WBZH. That's 910 AM. In Racine and Kenosha, 99.9 FM and 1400 AM. Also 98.1 FM in Kenosha, WRJN. In La Crosse, the Eagle, WLCX. That's AM 1490. And not to be outdone, in Eau Claire, the Tap, it's WCFN. That's 93.5. All of those broadcast stations of Civic Media joining us. And you can join us, too, as a part of our discussion here on the Saturday morning broadcast. Now, Amicus, a law review. Delighted to have you with me this morning. Let's talk more about the kinds of things we're going to be talking about just this morning. As I indicated, we're going to continue with a lot of the content, the substance of what we have done before. And that includes this morning. That includes this morning a major look once again at one of our common topics, and that is the United States Supreme Court. A lot of activity this past week, a lot of things to catch up on, too, in terms of cases that the Supreme Court has already decided. Not exclusively the Supreme Court this morning, but a lot of focus upon the highest court in the land. These nine folks, appointed by the president, confirmed by the United States Senate over time, lifetime tenure, having these dramatic impacts upon our lives and our livelihoods, as we have spoken about on our Saturday morning broadcast. And so this morning, we're going to spend some time talking about inventory, what the Supreme Court has in front of us right now. Talk a little bit about some of the decisions. Yes, indeed. They have already issued opinions in 11 different cases. I'm going to remind you of a few of those, maybe even all of them, but highlighting a couple that we have talked about in the past. I'm going to go to some oral arguments of just this past week, some major cases involving the First Amendment and social media and the connection between government and social media, a big theme this year of the Supreme Court, in addition, of course, to the Trump cases and the violence cases involving guns and other issues also pending before the Supreme Court. This morning, we're going to talk about two major oral arguments of early this past week having to do with the intersection of social media and the government and the First Amendment. And then necessarily, we're going to talk about that major immigration back and forth this past week having to do with that Texas law. What did the Supreme Court do? What did the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals do after the Supreme Court acted this past week? And provide you with just a little bit more, a brief update on our in-depth review of what Scott McAfee did last week. What did he do this present week, just this past week, in connection with the decision finding there was no conflict of interest by the prosecutor there in that Georgia case, but finding nonetheless an appearance of impropriety, directing basically that the principal lead prosecutor get off the case. Scott McAfee, the judge, did something else this week that also has an impact upon that decision of last week. A lot to get to this morning, a lot on our ambitious agenda, and we're going to launch into it right now on this, our newly styled, our newly reimagined show, Amicus, a Law Review. So let's begin by talking about the United States Supreme Court. Believe it or not, the Supreme Court has a 12-month term, and we're halfway through that at the end of March, even though that's a bit deceptive. Why? Because most of their decisions come out, as you know well, in May, June, sometimes as late as July. So we're expecting that probably 9 months into their term, at the end of June, end of July, most of the cases presently pending before the Supreme Court will be decided by then. The Supreme Court remains in action, remains active during those summer months as well before the start of the new term again in October of next year, of this year, October 1 of 2024. Right now, 62 cases pending before the Supreme Court. When we come back, I'm going to tell you more about those cases, other things happening before our United States Supreme Court.
On air at 92.7 megahertz frequency modulation. And streaming worldwide on the Civic Media app. This is Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Russian President Vladimir Putin promised retribution for Friday's attack at a concert hall in Moscow. Authorities now say over 130 people were killed. ISIS claimed responsibility, but ABC's Patrick Riebel says Russian authorities are pointing at Ukraine.
The FSB now claims that the attackers had contacts in Ukraine. Ukrainian officials have vehemently denied any involvement. They accuse Russia of trying to exploit this attack to further mobilize Russians for the war against Ukraine.
The Senate passed a $1.2 trillion spending bill, which funds the government for the rest of the fiscal year. President Biden's expected to sign it today. The president and first lady sent messages of support to Kate, the Princess of Wales, after she announced she is being treated for cancer. And the FBI sent a letter to passengers on the Alaska Airlines flight that saw a door plug blow off in midair in January that they might be the victims of a crime. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Wisconsin goes one and done. I'm Mike Clemens with sports. March Madness, the Wisconsin Badgers eliminated from the NCAA tournament. Too many missed shots, too many turnovers. They lose to James Madison University, 72-61. The Badgers season over with a record of 22-14. Marquette with a win over Western Kentucky, 87-69. They'll face Colorado on Sunday. Golden Eagles head coach Shaka Smart.
I thought Western Kentucky played with phenomenal aggressiveness in the first half. Hats off to their team, the way that they competed and battled. Fortunately, Tyler and Cam kept us afloat. You know, we were fortunate to only be down 7 at the half. So just grateful for the response. You know, we talk about building championship habits. One of the most important of those is the way we respond to adversity. And the guys did a great job of that today.
Hockey, the Wisconsin Badgers women's team beat Colgate 3-1. They'll advance to the finals against Ohio State on Sunday. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With weather, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly cloudy and highs in the low 40s. Snow likely tonight, lows around 25. Some snow on Sunday with a high near 40 degrees. Southeast winds up to 25 miles per hour. Rain and snow Sunday night, a low near 35. And rain for Monday, maybe even a rumble of thunder.
It's 24 right now.
Marcus is a connoisseur of anything that's free. So he was happy to read the disclaimer on TurboTax Free Edition.
Roughly 37% of taxpayers qualify. Form 1040 and limited credits only. See how at TurboTax.com. That's me!
File your taxes 100% free with TurboTax Free Edition and get your max refund guaranteed. See if you qualify to file for free at TurboTax.com. See max refund guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Tons of glass artists share the same passion for eye-catching art as Ignite Glass and Gifts. So we're showcasing their work alongside our talented local artists and our in-house Ignite artists. The latest techniques, the hottest colors, and mind-blowing designs are here for you to enjoy. Madison's favorite for glass, gifts, and vape, Ignite Glass and Gifts. Monona Drive, Williamson Street, and Odana Road. Plus, IgniteGlassandGifts.com. Do your eyes a favor and see this stuff.
Most of us can agree the decision to have an abortion should be between a person and their doctor. Politicians should have no say at all. Thankfully, Senator Tammy Baldwin is standing up for our rights and working to keep politicians out of our medical decisions. After Roe v. Wade, the court case that protected abortion rights was overturned, Tammy Baldwin introduced the Women's Health Protection Act, which would ensure access to abortion everywhere in the United States, including here in Wisconsin. The bill would end extreme abortion bans that have no exceptions for rape, incest, or the life of the mother, and threaten doctors with criminal charges for providing abortion care. Senator Baldwin also introduced legislation that would protect the right to travel across state lines for reproductive health care and safeguard access to contraception. Call Senator Tammy Baldwin at 202-224-5653. Tell her thank you for fighting back against extreme abortion bans. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
Whether you're hanging out on State Street or hanging out on the lakes, thanks for listening. This is Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
We are back on our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you for joining me and Anya. We're in the studios of WAUK in downtown Waukesha, but broadcasting to places throughout the state of Wisconsin. Delighted to have you with me this hour, hopefully next hour as well. This is our inaugural program under our newly styled name, Amicus, a law review. Talking a lot this morning about where that name comes from, friend of the court, but also offering information, expertise, insight that may have some bearing on the issues before us. That's also our mission here, not only in the courts of America, but also on this broadcast station, to spend some time talking with you about the major stories in the area of law and government, aspiration for justice mean, providing that additional perspective that may not come from the straight news stories. That's our mission here in this program. And consistent with that, spending some time, virtually all of our time this morning, talking once again about the United States Supreme Court. Halfway through its term at the end of this month, again, a new term, the 2024-2025 term, begins on October 1 of this year. But right now, the Supreme Court has before it some 62 different cases. In each one of those, the court has said, yes, we will take a look at the lower court decision. They granted what is called a writ of certiorari. That is this, once again, Latin phrase that means basically lower court, send me the materials, send me the stuff that you have assembled during the course of the lower court trial so that we can take a look at whether you have done this right, whether this is proper, consistent with the law, the Constitution, and fundamental principles of justice. And so those cases come from a number of different sources, of course, and those include principally, not exclusively, but principally the various appeals courts, the federal appeals courts around the country. Among that 62, 11 of the cases come from the Ninth Circuit alone. That's the major circuit on the west portion of the continental United States of America, and also including Alaska and Hawaii. 11 cases from the Ninth Circuit alone, 10 cases from the Fifth Circuit. Again, significant. We talk a lot about the Fifth Circuit on this broadcast. Why? Because they're doing a lot of things, including some things we're going to talk about this morning that draw the attention not only of Americans, but also the courts from throughout our nation, including the United States Supreme Court. 10 cases pending from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Only two from our own Seventh Circuit, which again is Wisconsin, Indiana, and Illinois. Only two of those cases coming from our own Seventh Circuit. Of course, as you know, a lot of time that we see the Supreme Court in action, it is in these oral arguments, the times after the briefs have been filed, including the amicus briefs that are sometimes filed, the briefs of the petitioners, the respondents, all the writing has been done by the lawyers, all of that submitted to the judges, the justices of the Supreme Court, and they then have these oral arguments, which you can listen to. You can listen to live. You can also go on the Supreme Court website and pull those down and listen to them in a recorded fashion. John Roberts has made that available to all of us. You can listen to those oral arguments live. You can hear what the justices sound like. You can hear about the conversations between the petitioners, the respondents, and the justices, sometimes even arguing among themselves about what should happen, asking questions, making points. We're going to get to some of that today as a part of our examination of at least one or two cases. Up to now, in this present 2023-2024 term, the Supreme Court has conducted 20 of those oral arguments in the fall of last year, 26 to date in 2024 alone, even since January 1. So altogether, 46 up to this time. 15 more of those oral arguments are yet scheduled in March and April. And then at the end of April, Supreme Court is pretty much done with those oral arguments. So you can always go back in line and hear those oral arguments. Pretty much done at the end of April. They have scheduled 15 more cases. And yes, indeed, as you know, those cases include two that we've spoken about at great length on this broadcast. On April 16th, this Fisher case that has to do with whether or not the statute under which Mr. Fisher, who's one of the people who was convicted for his assault upon the Capitol on January 6th, whether his conviction should stand based upon the nature and the content of the federal statute under which he was charged. The reason why that case is so important is because not only, of course, does it impact Mr. Fisher's status, but it's also the case under which many, many other of the other prosecutions were brought. That is about 120 or so
other defendants were also charged under the same statute. And there's yet another defendant out there. His name is Donald Trump. And he was also charged under the same statute, different set of facts, different kind of so-called talking indictment. That one brought, again, by Jack Smith, the U.S. Department of Justice. That case right now suspended while the Supreme Court does what? Well, here's a case on immunity. And the Fisher case, again, for oral argument on the 16th of April, Supreme Court going to decide ultimately, probably in June, whether that statute can in fact be applied to Mr. Fisher, to those 100 or so other defendants also charged and convicted, and perhaps even Donald Trump in his criminal prosecution in the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia. Much related to that, already suggested by me, is that on the 25th of April, about a week or so later, the very last day of oral argument before the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court hearing Trump versus United States, and yes, that is the immunity case. This is the case in which Donald Trump, through his attorneys, petitioning to the court, asking the court to find, as a matter of law, under these facts, but more generally, that presidents have immunity for their conduct, their criminal conduct, while they're in the White House. A ridiculous proposition from the perspectives of many of us, including me. A frivolous argument. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court taking this up, already the subject of a lower court opinion from Judge Tanya Chutkan, finding, nope, we do not have kings in America. We've got presidents who are, in fact, subject to law, not immune. The Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia coming to the same conclusion in an equally magnanimous and really sweeping order, finding the same end. Supreme Court now taking that up, further postponing the prosecution of Donald Trump while all of this is underway. That immunity argument scheduled before the Supreme Court on April 25th, coming up in just about a month from now. That is the last oral argument the Supreme Court is going to be taking up in this term. And then we wait until probably late May, in June, and perhaps even in July for the Supreme Court to come up and issue the remaining decisions. And it's got a lot of them that it has yet to offer. We know already that the Supreme Court has decided, believe it or not, among that 62 cases pending, among those that are scheduled for oral argument, it's already decided 11 of those. 11 of those already decided. So, for example, among those kinds of cases, as early as December 5th, the Supreme Court decided a case called Acheson versus Laufer, had to do with the ADA, basically said there's no standing there, had the case reversed, if you will, sent back to the lower court based upon mootness, a mootness issue there, but potentially raised an Americans with Disability Act issue support. The court did not get to that. A major case argued on February 8th called Murray versus UBS Securities, having to do with whistleblower status. On that same date, February 8th, the Supreme Court, in a case called Rural Housing versus Kurtz, heard oral arguments on a case involving the Fair Credit Reporting Act. A couple weeks later, on February 21st, a couple of additional important oral arguments, or decisions rather, that the Supreme Court issued. One of them called McElrath versus Georgia, a double jeopardy case. A double jeopardy case, sending the case back down to Georgia based upon a double jeopardy decision by the Supreme Court. And also on that same day, February 21st, a case called Raiders Retreat versus Great Lakes, having to do with maritime law. That case also decided on the 21st of February. A few more also among the 11 or so decided to this time. March 15th was another big day. Pulsifer, a major case, Pulsifer versus United States, having to do with sentencing, federal sentencing in our trial courts, having to do with minimum mandatories and safety valves. On that same day, March 15th, also two major cases, Linke and Gardner, social media cases. We're going to review those in just a moment or so as we get back into the entire social media docket right now on the Supreme Court's list. And of course, you recall well this major case on March 4th. March 4th issued Trump versus Anderson. That's the Colorado case. We spent a lot of time talking about that case on this broadcast. The Supreme Court finding unanimously with respect to the judgment, but a lot of dissent about the extent to which the Supreme Court went beyond what some of the dissenters felt they needed to do in finding that, yes, indeed, Donald Trump is going to remain on the primary ballot in Colorado and presumably other states around the nation, including places like Maine and Illinois and maybe some 30 other states that also were waiting for the decision, Donald Trump remains on the primary ballot because why? The Supreme Court says only the legislature, only the federal legislature can make that decision to remove him under the 14th Amendment. We've talked a lot about that. Trump versus Anderson case issued on March 4th. A couple other cases issued on the 19th. A case called FBI versus Fickrey involving the no-fly list. And Wilkinson versus Garland also issued recently having to do with agency determinations and things lawyers love, mixed questions of law and fact. All kinds of things the Supreme Court has already decided. 11 cases up to now. Again, has about 50 or so more to decide. Lots of activity coming up. Probably most of that a little bit in May. Probably most of that once again in June and July as the Supreme Court resolves all of these matters before it, including the oral arguments still coming up. We talked last time about these major social media cases, including specifically this case involving the interaction between government and social media. The Supreme Court on Friday of last week, the previous week, issued a pair of unanimous decisions on these two paired cases on a subject that has roiled the waters of all levels of government, having to do with what government can and cannot do. The question is, when do public officials, elected or unelected, when do they violate the First Amendment by blocking? Yes, that's right, blocking critics from their personal social media pages. And again, we talked about this a lot last week. Important to set the stage for important oral arguments the Supreme Court had just this past week in this same area. So let's go back and talk a little bit more about this case. Michigan and California, some outraged citizens sued public officials there who were blocking them from those personal media pages. In one case, two elected school board members in Colorado had blocked some persistently critical parents from their social media pages. And in Michigan, a local resident sued an unelected city manager for kind of doing the same thing. He was blocked from the officer's Facebook page and, of course, expressing quite different views when it comes to social media. The individual in Michigan maintaining that the city manager violated his right to speak by blocking him from responding to things that the city manager had said on his personal page about COVID-19 and other matters. The petitioner said Mr. Freed, that's the city manager, was putting out policy directives. He was issuing press statements. And this was the only place the information was being relayed to the community. Freed, of course, replied that simply wasn't true. He answered constituent questions and pointed to them to press releases and other sites for local information. But 80% of the posts, he said, on my personal feed, my personal basis for my personal social media account, those were family photos and pictures of my dog, he said. I had a thought for a moment that this page was public and that I didn't control it. I would never have posted photos of my little girls or my wife, he said. Well, the Supreme Court, in the end, as we know from last week's exposition, didn't decide who was right, but it said basically we're going to lay down some guidelines for the lower courts in assessing the facts as we go forward in determining, again, this relationship between government and private citizens. Writing for the court, Amy Coney Barrett said that a post that expressly invokes state authority to make an announcement not available elsewhere is official, and members of the public are entitled to make comments in response. But a post that merely repeats or shares otherwise available information is more likely personal. The owner of the page may well be able to block critical or unwelcome comments. Who provides this information about standards going forward? When we come back, we're going to talk about the implications of that in connection with a couple of Supreme Court oral arguments of just this past Monday in the area of social media, government, and all of us.
You're listening to Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected to your local community. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
Did you know Madison is part of the First Nature Everywhere program? It's a partnership with the National Children in Nature Network, and as one of just 19 cities selected from across the country, it's meant to ensure every resident has an equal opportunity to connect with nature. As a Nature Everywhere community, Madison is going to receive 2 years of support, planning, and startup money to create new ways for children and families to enjoy nature-based experiences and learning. By the way, studies show spending time outside is good for your health, and for kids, it can even mean improvements in school. Want to help? Email natureeverywhere@cityofmadison.com. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
Mad Radio 92.7 FM, home of the John and Gordy Show.
We are back on this, the final segment of our first hour here on our newly styled Saturday morning broadcast named Amicus, a law review. We're talking about some Supreme Court oral arguments, specifically in the area of social media, the interaction between residents of our state, our nation, and government. What, in fact, can public officials do, elected or unelected officials do, when it comes to blocking individuals on their personal accounts, accounts that may, in fact, have information of a public interest? And so Amy Coney Barrett, in a couple of cases, again, Linkey versus Freed and O'Connor Ratcliffe versus Garnier, last week said the distinction between private conduct and state action turns on substance, not labels, she said. Private parties can act with the authority of the state, and state officials have private lives and their own constitutional rights. Categorizing conduct, therefore, can require a closer look. And again, establishing some standards, not deciding these two cases coming out of California and Michigan, but sending them back with some new standards for the lower courts to apply in determining whether or not the particular state officials, the government officials, had violated the First Amendment rights of residents who feel that by virtue of the postings on these social media posts, these accounts, they are no longer permitted to see things in the public domain, a violation of their First Amendment. So we'll continue to monitor those cases as they go forward. Among the 11 cases, the Supreme Court has already decided. Other cases, however, in the social media realm, not yet decided. And that includes two major social media cases before the Supreme Court just this past week. Let's talk about one of them. The first one called Murphy versus Missouri. And yes, indeed, during the course of the oral arguments, again, these times when the petitioners, the respondents, the parties have this chance to talk with the court members, hear questions from them, comments, respond to the concerns that the Supreme Court justices have. During the course of them, references were made between the two cases. One of them, again, Murphy versus Missouri. The other one, NRA versus Vullo, V-U-L-L-O. We're going to talk about those at the end of this first hour, the beginning of our second hour here on Amicus, a law review. A majority of the justices appeared convinced on Monday of just this past week, ultimate rule here, if you will, that government officials should be able to try to persuade private companies. They should be given that authority, whether news organizations or tech platforms, social media providers, government officials should be able to try to persuade them not to publish information so long as the requests are not backed by coercive threats, so long as there's no threatening behavior going on. That appears to be where the Supreme Court is coming down on this major issue. A majority of the Supreme Court seemed wary on Monday at this oral argument of this bid by these two states, again, Missouri and Louisiana, to limit what the Biden administration, its interactions with some social media companies. Several justices questioning the state's legal theories and factual assertions. Most of the justices across the board, if you will, appeared convinced that government officials should be able to try to persuade private companies, again, anyone who's providing a social media platform, news organizations, tech platforms, those kinds of entities, not to public information so long as those requests are not backed by some coercive threats. The dispute, of course, is the latest in the series of cases that we've talked about in this area of social media.
Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Elena Kagan, both former White House lawyers, bringing that past experience to the oral argument just on Monday, said that interactions between administration officials and news outlets provided, as they described this, a valuable analogy. Efforts by officials to influence coverage, they said, are a part of valuable dialogue that is not prohibited by the First Amendment. So you've got at least two justices there, presumably weighing in, saying, states, you're wrong about this. Some members of the court during the course of the oral argument on Monday also raised some questions about whether the plaintiffs, Missouri and Louisiana, and about five other individuals along for the ride here, had suffered the kind of injury that permitted them to establish standing. Remember that concept? You've got to be able to show that you've suffered some damage, some injury specifically. Wondered whether or not Missouri and Louisiana are really damaged themselves by this. They also suggest along the way that some broad injunction, some stopping, prohibiting contacts between government officials and the platforms was not a proper remedy in any event. So, for example, Justice Kagan said this to Louisiana's attorney, the Solicitor General from that state. She said, I don't see a single item in your brief that would satisfy our normal tests, she said. Justice Sonia Sotomayor accused the states of distorting the record in this case. She said this, I have such a problem with your brief, she said. You omit information that changes the context of some of your claims. That's not good language to be hearing from a Supreme Court justice when you're appearing in front of them, especially Sonia Sotomayor, who does not mince words. She said, you attribute things to people who it didn't happen to. Not a good day for the Solicitor General in front of Sonia Sotomayor and the other justices. They also peppered him with hypothetical questions about national security, doxing of public officials, contexts that would perhaps endanger teenagers, all suggesting that if there is, in fact, a role for vigorous efforts by the government officials, again elected, appointed, to combat harmful speech. Only Sam Alito, perhaps not too surprising, a member of the court who appeared most sympathetic, if you will, although even he wasn't vigorous in that, to the state's position. He said, whatever coercion means, whatever happened here is sufficient. The case, of course, arose, as I indicated, from this barrage of communications from the Biden administration urging some social media platforms to take down posts on what on topics like the coronavirus vaccines, indicating that they're not effective, or providing other information suggesting that some remedies are in fact effective when they're not. Claims of election fraud as well. Members of the Biden administration reaching out to some of the platform providers saying that's simply not true. The 2020 election was not stolen. And last year, a federal appeals court severely limited those interactions. The Supreme Court had put that injunction, that stop, on hold while it considered the administration's appeal. And this, of course, followed. Justice Alito, during the course of this oral argument on Monday, said that the volume and the intensity of the contacts between the Biden administration and social media providers was troubling. And the suggestion there was that some of them, faced with this government intrusion, were partners in an effort to combat misinformation about the pandemic, establishing a partnership that is not appropriate under the First Amendment. Under this onslaught, he said, the platforms routinely cave behind closed doors. The government badgers the platforms 24/7. So again, Justice Alito not supporting what the Biden administration was doing, but most of the other justices doing just that. When we come back in our second hour, more about this all-important case, reading the tea leaves from the oral argument of the United States Supreme Court of just this past Monday. Stay with us in our second hour coming up after this break.
Not sure what's better, a win at Camp Randall Stadium or just hanging out at the farmer's market. This is Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 11 till noon on the talk you can't ignore. Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX and on the Civic Media app.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
You're listening to Mad Radio. WMDX 1580 AM Columbus. W224 EG Madison. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Russian authorities say at least 133 people are dead after Friday's attack on a